Welcome to Beyond Your Front Door, your adventure guide to the Central Oregon coast. I'm your host, Dina Pavlis. I'm pleased to have in the studio today author Tom Bach. This is our third and final show of a trilogy of Tom's Out Our Back Door series guidebooks. Today's show will feature his Oregon South Coast Bike Ride Guide, which is a great resource for road and mountain bikers here on the coast. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Dina. It's good to be here again.
This is the third and final show in our trilogy of your Out Our Back Door Oregon South Coast guidebooks. Just to let listeners know before we get started, our previous two shows covered your Oregon South Coast Kayak, Canoe, and SUP guide and your guide for South Coast driving tours and day hikes. People can find those previous shows online at soundcloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door Oregon and look for The Wave. So let's jump in. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I had some success with my first book, Out Our Back Door, about driving tours and day hikes, and I saw the potential for a bike book, plus I could use some of the same information and maps.
And I see that your book covers both road and mountain biking from Florence all the way down to the California border, and the book is broken into two parts. So let's start first with the section that covers the Oregon Coast bike route. And my first question is, what is the Oregon Coast bike route?
It's a 370-mile route that mostly follows or is U.S. 101. It was designated in 1982, and at the time it was thought this would be adding another component to the recreation and tourism potential of the Oregon coast. And there was always a point made that it was for locals and tourists to enjoy. So the good news is it offers lots of spectacular scenery of the famous Oregon coast, but the downside is there's lots of summer traffic on US 101, and there are many places where the designated bike lane is narrow or, in the worst case, is non-existent, and supposedly the state is making improvements. And there are three or four worthy detours that take you off busy Highway 101 on the north coast. That's Three Capes Scenic Loop and at Otter Crest. Here on the central and south coast at Seven Devils by Charleston and Beach Loop Drive in Bandon and the old coast highway north of Gold Beach. The south coast, in many people's minds, is even more spectacular than the north coast, and it's certainly less populated, a little less traffic. Oh, and by the way, the route links to California's version of a coastal route. And as it turned out, there were some worthy road riding opportunities in Del Norte County by Crescent City. So in they went into my guidebook, because the fun doesn't stop at the California border, as they say.
No, it doesn't. And I agree with you. I think the South Coast is really beautiful, especially all those sea stacks that are out there. And I'm curious about the Oregon Coast bike route. Do you have preferred directions that you recommend people ride at different times of the year?
Well, the most obvious is the wind direction. Comes from the south in winter and north in summer. So in summer, you almost exclusively see bicyclists riding the Oregon Coast bike route from north to south, taking advantage of the tailwind. Sometimes you see cyclists struggling along in the opposite direction, and I guess some of them have a legitimate reason for doing it that way, or maybe they're just doing one section or something. But other times you kind of wonder if they didn't get the memo, so I'll read in my book or some other source of information about the wind. The best time of year, as we've talked about on our previous sessions, is late summer and into early autumn, you know, Indian summer. The wind dies down, the traffic thins out, the kids are back in school, so it's really a trifecta of good conditions.
I didn't think about having a tailwind to actually help you. I have tried riding against the wind just locally here. And at one time, the wind was so strong, I had to get off my bike, lock it, and walk somewhere to, because I didn't have it, my cell phone wouldn't come in where I was, and walk somewhere and call my husband to come and get me with his truck. Because I was like, there's no way I can ride against this. It's going to blow me over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Well, we talked a little bit about the weather and we talked about some of the traffic, but is there anything else that people should consider if they're attempting to complete all or part of the Oregon Coast bike route?
Well, over the years, the bike route has been wildly popular, and it wasn't unusual to see large groups of 75 or more cyclists along the route, which is, as noted, is mostly along Highway 101 with a few worthy detours. But I don't know whether it's COVID-related or what, but I and the bike shop owners I talked to haven't seen nearly so many large groups in the past couple of years. And again, we're not exactly sure why, COVID or what. But yeah, and you certainly see smaller groups of riders coming through on a regular basis all summer long. The wintertime riding never really amounted to many people, but you still see occasional riders. And as you know, the weather is often very nice in winter. Sometimes it's even nicer than it is in summer.
Right.
Sunny and no wind. But and as I said, the best time is Indian summer, early autumn.
You know, I'll just mention, I agree with you about the groups. We definitely stopped seeing large groups during COVID, but this is the first summer now. I can think of probably about four times just in the past few months where, as I've been driving up to the lighthouse, I've seen large groups where people are pulling trailers, you know, behind them or in front of them, and then large groups of bikers behind that. And so I think maybe that did have something to do with COVID, right? Because there may be at some point that those are like group tours, right? And so let's hope those are back. Yeah, I've seen that and it's been really nice to see. So the second section of your book, which also spans Florence to the California border, covers both road and mountain bike treks within certain cities or trail areas. Are most of those loops or how does that work?
Well, I wanted to have the opportunity for mountain bike and road rider biking for each community on the South Coast. This, again, was for locals and visitors. I envisioned somebody in Coquille, say, wanting to see if there are any biking options in that town. So each town has routes, mostly informal, often along rural back roads leading in and out of town. So the coverage actually begins north of Florence at Cape Perpetua and then includes some in-town options, such as around the lakes north and south of town. And there are also directions to the alternate routes toward the Willamette Valley, such as Smith River route out of Reedsport and the Powers Glendale route in the Siskiyou National Forest south of Powers, among other inland routes.
Okay, that's awesome. And one of the things I was thinking about as I was looking through your book is that there are a lot of steep hills here on the coast, and sometimes I see people riding up some of those steep hills, and I'm wondering, for both road and mountain bike riding, do you have any tips for people who are completing some of these rides?
Well, yes. For example, mountain bike rides in the Elliott State Forest, some people may prefer to drive up and ride the ridges versus trying to ride up to the ridge from down below, because that often goes from sea level to 2,500 feet in less than a mile, believe it or not. So that's a pretty intense bit of uphill pedaling. So, but once you get up at elevation, it's sort of just like you float along the ridgeline. So that's one way to deal with steep hills. Of course, real bicyclists love the challenge. So some of us look at it as a obstacle, and others say, oh, what a great workout.
Yeah.
I just try to, you know, be as clear as possible, and along with providing elevation charts so people know what they're getting into and where the high point is, at which point it's sort of downhill back. So relief comes. In many communities, as I said, you can find rides that pretty much stay at sea level with very few significant ups and downs, such as the route around Florence, taking in Rhododendron Drive to Hasita Beach, and then come back along via the road along Siusa River's North Fork, which, by the way, is a great ride, too, in the North Fork, just even if it's just out and back.
Yeah, that's a beautiful one. You mentioned, when you said some riders like the challenge of those steep hills, you said some of us. And so that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is, I really love that each ride that you talk about, there's like a discussion section, and it talks about what people can expect on the ride. So I want to ask you, did you ride all of these roads and trails, or did you have help compiling this information?
Well, I rode, or actually, truth be told, pushed my bike on all of the routes several times. The biggest challenge was the elevation charts I was just mentioning. I provide for most of the rides where it's an issue. If it's all along sea level, obviously you don't need an elevation chart. I had a classic analog altimeter loaned to me by the Bureau of Land Management. It was sort of encouraging this process, and GPS units were just coming available to the general public, so I used sort of a clunky early version. And I often brought both the analog and digital ones along, and of course they never agreed
on
the readings, but they were usually close enough that I could just average. We're only talking about a foot or two at the most. So that was probably the biggest challenge.
It's pretty incredible to think that you actually did all of the rides in there in one way or another, whether it was sometimes pushing or sometimes pedaling.
Yeah. Well, it took me years.
I would think so. How long did it take you to put this book together, actually?
Well, it's hard to say because I was, you know, I would let it alone for a couple of weeks. It kept getting slid to the back burner, you know, hard to say, a couple of years at least.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and like you say, it's not like you can go out and ride all the time. And then sometimes the weather also impacts your ability to do that. That would delay the book as well.
Yeah. And then dealing with, as the previously mentioned, Elliott State Forest, it could almost kind of get discouraging sometimes because there was so much potential there. And I just would look at the map going, I'm never going to figure this out.
Yeah.
What have I got myself into? But just have to take it in little chunks and learning which places would be more appropriate. So there was decisions to make along the way. But in a lot of cases, it was fun.
Yeah,
yeah,
good.
Sometimes it was like, oh, no. Where? What?
What have I gotten myself into now?
Yeah.
Well, since your book came out, you were talking about how you had to figure out some of the altitudes and other things here on the coast. I'm wondering, since your book came out, phone maps and apps have become popular as well. I don't think they're always as good as a guidebook because the guidebook, you know that the person's been there and they're telling you exactly what they've experienced. But I'm wondering, can you recommend any phone apps that might help people navigate both road and off-road routes once they get out to the areas mentioned in your book?
The most popular one is called trailforks.com. And it's especially useful as they, for example, provided almost daily updates during the construction of the Whiskey Run mountain bike trail system between Coos Bay and Bandon. So that's the one I notice most mountain bikers and road riders use. That gives you sort of turn-by-turn directions if you want. I still use the odometer as the most reliable source since GPS and other devices can sometimes lose their signal, especially in the mountains or canyons where the GPS can't triangulate on satellites to get a constant, reliable signal. Your odometer almost never has that problem as long as you don't inadvertently zero it out or something halfway along. It's not that much of an issue when you're on the Oregon Coast bike route since it basically follows US 101 and rarely loses signals. And then as far as the riders on the Oregon Coast bike route, one of the niftiest aspects is that South Coast communities are almost all 25 miles apart from each other, so that makes it easier to plan or figure out routes or determine how much you'd like to ride every day, or maybe just do a segment, say, from Florence to Reedsport. You can sort of say, well, that's 25 miles from there to Coos Bay, to Bandon, to Port Orford, to Gold Beach, to Brookings. Sort of handy.
Yeah, that's super nice. Well, you have really a lot of great routes in the book, and I'm wondering, do you have one or two favorite routes in the book, or is it just too hard to pick one?
Well, for mountain biking right now, a top choice is that excellent Whiskey Run mountain bike trail system between Coos Bay and Bandon on Coos County forest land. My book came out before the trail system was developed, but I created a sticker map for the inside back cover that shows the vehicle routes to the various trailheads. And then once there, there are paper maps usually available on the information kiosk. But I realize it's not really feasible to expect people to keep referring to a paper map or flipping open my book. So, again, most riders these days have GPS devices or odometers. But still, in this case, the best place to go is at trailforks.com. I mentioned because they have almost daily updates on trail conditions and turn-by-turn directions. And as far as road riding favorite route is probably the officially designated one in Port Orford that goes along the highway up to the Elk River and then up Elk River about 18 miles and then comes back down to 101 and then goes up to Cape Blanco State Park and goes out to the tip of the Cape at the light, and then back into town on a slightly different route. So it's pretty gratifying loop-wise, and traffic is very mellow there too. So that would be my top choice for a road riding route on the South Coast.
Ooh, nice. That sounds like a really nice ride. Tom, what were some of the biggest challenges that you had in writing this book?
Initially trying to figure out how to handle road riders as well as mountain bikers, and at the time there weren't as many opportunities as exist now, enough to justify separate books. So I eventually decided to present both opportunities, which immediately doubled my workload.
Oh, no.
But I like to think it made the book more appealing. And while there are riders who are either road riders or mountain bikers, there are folks who do both. You'll see vehicles with both kinds of on their racks, you know. So I thought that might widen my appeal. Otherwise, some of the challenges were more obvious, trying to figure out routes and loops whenever possible and how far to delve into either or both. A real challenge, as I mentioned, was at Elliott State Forest. So many potential routes and loops, and riding and driving them took a long time and even longer to draw accurate maps, because I figured if I put in one road X, let's say, I better put in all the connections, even the dead ends, otherwise it's not going to be as helpful. So there's a lot of work going up and down every worthy road to check it out. It took me a long time.
So one of the things I'm thinking about is the rise in popularity of e-bikes, and sometimes I see them with the fat tires out on the sand dunes and beaches. Have you put out any updated versions to your book to include beach and dune riding?
Not specifically, but beach and dunes cruising with those big fat tires bikes is getting more and more popular. I see their tracks in many places you'd never think a bicyclist would take on. It's sometimes sort of unsettling seeing them out there sort of floating along above the dunes.
Yeah.
Fortunately, except for the tire tracks, they don't seem to be making too much of an impact, although purists might disagree, and I'm sure it's something that dunes administrators are keeping an eye on. But I must say, also, it can be a bit of a dent in the budget if you start amassing the various kinds of bikes, regular road bikes, mountain bikes, beach cruisers, e-bikes. And there are subcategories of e-bikes, you know, pedal-assisted only or full motorized type. So there's a lot of choices to try out and enjoy. I guess if it gets people out there, it's a win.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Tom, one of my favorite parts of this show, as you well know, is asking people to share a favorite memory or experience. And I'm wondering, can you share a favorite memory related to either the writing of this book or to your biking escapades?
It's always fun sleuthing out potential routes. And the big prize is figuring out if some kind of loop can be made. Sometimes there were near misses, especially, again, in the Elliott State Forest. I would see some potential route on a map and a couple roads that almost linked, or thinking maybe bikers could just carry their bikes across a dicey section, only to find out when actually visiting that it was a big impassable ravine or something that precluded having the road go through in the first place. So visiting the forest, back roads often involved coming across big logging operations that would block the road temporarily, and I always felt guilty making the action stop, whether I was exploring with my vehicle or actually biking. But on every occasion, the guys on these jobs couldn't have been more accommodating. One time they even temporarily smoothed out a way for me to get through, and then it promptly got all turned up again as soon as I was clear of it.
And
that
I love
time
that.
I was really, really hoping I could make a loop out of the thing out there and not hang them up again.
That's a great story. I just want to take a moment to let listeners know, if you tuned in late, you've been listening to Beyond Your Front Door. This show is produced for the Pacifica Radio Network in the studios of KXCR here in beautiful downtown Florence, Oregon. I've been speaking with author Tom Bach. Tom is the author of several South Coast recreation guides, and this show is focusing on his Oregon South Coast Bike Rides Guide. If you missed any portion of this show or the previous two shows, the one about paddling and the one about driving trips and day hikes, you can find this show and those on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door, Oregon, and look for The Wave. Tom, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
Dina, I again applaud you for taking on this worthy work of promoting our great coast and all the potential recreational offerings. And as I said before on our previous interviews, I really encourage listeners to check back over those previous broadcasts because there are little tips and helpful info in all of them, and especially for places slightly off the beaten path that don't get many visitors. And a final word for bicyclists, remember, be aware of vehicles. Most people don't like bikes on the narrow roads, and I hate giving them more ammo by being an unaware bicyclist. You know, don't ride two abreast, for example, unless there's no traffic around, and move over if there is. It's all just common sense and courtesy, really, no matter what kind of conveyance we're traveling on. Just, you know, use your head and be courteous and don't, as I said, give more ammo to dislike bicyclists. We got to share the road. So there's my sermon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Tom. And thanks for your kind words about my show. And I feel the same about your guidebooks. It's just, they're such a great resource to all of the things that are available for people to do here on the coast. So thank you for all that you've done to contribute as well. And again, I appreciate you taking time to be here today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Stay tuned. The Hoska brothers are taking us around the campfire, and I'll be right back with more Beyond Your Front Door.
Going to the campfire, gonna hear a little music. Going to the campfire, gonna have a little fun. Sitting around the campfire, singing late into the evening. Learning things I'll soon pass along. I pass along. Learning things I'll soon pass along.
Today I would like to share about one of our more interesting spiders found here on the coast, the goldenrod crab spider. Often I see them as very large yellow or white spiders on the flowers in my garden. Sometimes they have a red body stripe as well. The female of the species is twice the size of the male, coming in at about 10 millimeters, while the size of the males are about 5 millimeters. Most often I notice the females due to their large size and also due to their hunting tactics. Goldenrod crab spiders do not trap prey in webs like other spiders. Instead, they crouch down in flowers with their front legs spread wide, waiting for an unsuspecting bee, fly, or butterfly to land nearby. Then they spring forward, attempting to bite the insect, immobilizing it with their venom, a neurotoxin, which, by the way, is fairly harmless to humans. This paralyzing hunting tactic allows them to capture insects that are much larger than them. They also secrete digestive enzymes into the insects they catch, allowing the spider to digest internal portions of the insect, leaving the outside intact. Sometimes I think I see sleeping bees, but they are instead the ghostly remains of the spider's victims. Goldenrod crab spiders have the ability to change colors for camouflage, ranging from white to light green to yellow. And one article even suggested pink, but I haven't been able to verify that. Oregon State University reports that it takes the spiders up to 6 days to turn from yellow to white. But it takes much longer, 10 to 25 days, to turn from white to yellow. Why so much longer to go from white to yellow versus the other direction? OSU states that it's because the spiders excrete yellow pigment when changing to white. But they have to first produce yellow pigment to turn yellow, and that process takes longer. Studies suggest that the change in color does not necessarily result in more successful hunting, but may play a role in camouflaging them from predators. One of the other things I find fascinating about these spiders is the 8 moving eyes that sit atop their head, with the 2 frontmost eyes sometimes appearing red. The eyes are hard to see unless you look closely. The males are much smaller and differ in color with brown legs and body. The only white on the male is on the abdomen. While the females do not weave webs for hunting, they do use their silk for other things. The females will leave a trail of silk that the male spiders follow to locate the females for mating purposes. Females also wrap their eggs in sacks of silk and fold over a leaf to conceal them. They then remain with and guard the eggs until they hatch, which takes about 3 weeks, at which point the female spider dies. I have a video I took of a female goldenrod crab spider in my yard. I will share it on my social media page when I air this show. The video shows a female hunting, but the bee gets away, so don't worry. There are plenty of other videos of the spiders as well on YouTube and other social media sites. Today's nature sound is... Stay tuned. I'll be back in 35 seconds to let you know who makes that sound. Listeners who use information from this program to venture outdoors do so at their own risk. Outdoor activities may be hazardous and must be carefully evaluated for each listener based on that person's circumstances. KXCR and the individuals involved in this program, Pacifica Radio, or any station airing this program do not assume any liability from the use of any information presented. By using this information to enjoy your own coastal adventures, you assume all potential risks and agree to hold Pacifica Radio, KXCR, its affiliates, any station airing this program, and the presenters harmless from any resulting liability. Here's that nature sound again. Found on all continents except Antarctica, the peregrine falcon is a fast-flying raptor that can reach an impressive 200 miles per hour while diving or swooping down on its prey. Even at other times, the peregrine maintains impressive speeds, averaging 30 miles per hour while flying and up to 70 miles per hour when directly pursuing its prey. It's no wonder that for thousands of years, falconers trained these birds for hunting purposes. Two places on the central coast where I often see a peregrine is at Yaquinahead on the rocks out beyond the lighthouse and at Hasitahead at the very top by the lighthouse, off the very northwest corner of the fence. There is also a pair of peregrines that nest each year at Yaquinahead on the cliffs above the visitor center, giving local photographers and bird watchers a thrill each season. The peregrine may be an aggressive hunter, but it has its own predators, including golden eagles, great horned owls, and believe it or not, other peregrine falcons. Missed a show recently? You can find all of our shows on SoundCloud.com. Just search for Beyond Your Front Door, Oregon, and look for The Wave. Have an idea for a show you would like to hear? Email me at dina@kxcr.net to share your idea. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations KBOO, KCEI, Pacific Northwest Radio, and KXCR for airing Beyond Your Front Door. Thanks to Oregon-based Jump in the Rails for performing the song Smith Chapel used on this show. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.